Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week I talk to Paul Collier. He's one of the game's leading referees. He's refereed two World Finals and plenty more besides. Paul also works as one of World Snooker's tournament directors, and he explains in this podcast how he came to be a referee, talks about his career, and tells us exactly what a tournament director actually does. Paul, tell us how you discovered this great sport of snooker.
It goes back to when I was about 5 years of age, I suppose. My parents ran a social club in Newport, and we had a snooker table in it. It was called the Pioneer Club, which fortunately shut down quite recently. But I can remember on a Sunday afternoon, my Uncle Stephen used to work behind the bar with my dad, and licensing laws were different then, so everywhere used to close at 2 o'clock on a Sunday. And they'd go and have a game of snooker while my mother and my auntie cooked dinner upstairs, so I just used to watch them knocking balls about. And I don't think either of them ever made a 30 break in their lives, but you know, they used to enjoy it, and it was just something I'd always been around.
And did you play yourself?
I started playing when I was about 13, again with my dad at a different social club, and I fell in love with the game really. I really enjoyed it. It was a good excuse to get out of the house. I spent a bit of time with my dad. It was a nice club, the Mainly Cons Club in Newport, good crowd of boys. I learnt a lot from them and had a great time.
But at some young age, because a lot of sort of kids growing up, they think, I want to be a snooker player. But at some young age, you thought, no, I want to be a referee.
Well, actually, I did want to be a player. Right. And we had a coach in Newport, a guy called Vic Jones, that anybody that ever went to Ponding will remember. Vic, he died a few years ago, fortunately. But I went to Vic for a bit of coaching, and he was a coach and a ref, and part of his deal was he would only coach people if you learned to be a referee. Yeah. He said that you deserve to learn the rules, you know, because it's a big part of the sport you're playing. And I just found I really enjoyed it when I did learn the rules. And it was a bit easier. I got on very well with Darren Morgan at the time. Darren had just won the World Amateur Championship, and I used to practice with Darren a little bit, and I started travelling with Darren and reffing some of his matches when he was getting to the final stages of Pro-Ams. And I just found it was nice to always be involved at the end, because the playing wasn't going the way I wanted it to.
But it should be said, you were very young at this point.
I was 15 when I passed my first referee's exam. So, which I don't think anybody else did it. I think a lot of the people that Vic coached, he was coaching the older players because they would learn the rules. A lot of the youngsters didn't want to. There was a very good female player at the time, still is a very good female player, Sharon Dixon. And Sharon and I were about the same age, there might be a few months between us. And she didn't want to do the reffing side of it, she just wanted to play, and she was a better player than I was anyway. But no, I really stuck with the reffing and I really enjoyed it.
So how long was it then until you started reffing sort of professional matches?
It was a bit of a gap. I was doing a lot of amateur stuff in the Welsh Association, because we had a great Welsh amateur, you know, a great tour then, a lot of tournaments. So every weekend there was something on, and I did that up until I was about 19. Then of course I started work, I didn't have as much free time. But then when the game went open in 1991, I received an invitation from the Professional Referees Association through a few of the Welsh refs that I work with. And I'd met John Williams a few times, I think he was chairman at the time. I took the invitation up. So I was made a member, I think, in the December, either November or December of 1991. And then in 1992, they offered me 2 months at Blackpool in the first ever Norbrett qualifying stint.
Because that's the thing, when the game went open, obviously there were so many more matches, so many more players, they needed more officials, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we used to have, 22 tables, 3 sessions a day. So we'd have had probably 37, 38 referees on site every day for the best part of 3 months. So it needed a lot of us, because nobody could commit to that sort of time spell. A lot of people were working. I was lucky I was between jobs. There was a club I'd been involved with that closed in the May, and then I got offered that job in the June, which was perfect timing for me, really. That was a great time, and I had some good fortune on the back of somebody else's misfortune, because I'd done the first 2 months and was doing really well. Well, I thought I was, but there were a lot of experienced referees, and they were all getting the third month, and the new refs, it was sort of, well, thank you very much, we'll see you next season. And unfortunately, Len Ganley had a stroke about 4 days before the end of that first stint. And obviously they had a little meeting between John Street and John Williams and a couple of others, and they came to me and asked me to stay on for the extra month. So that was where it all really started.
Refereeing in those days, it was a little bit of a closed shop. I mean, if you watched snooker on telly, it was the same 4 or 5 people who tended to referee the matches. Here, you're this sort of new young referee. How did the sort of older refs take to you? Did they sort of take you under their wing, or were some of them a little bit maybe suspicious of you?
Yeah, John Williams, Len, Alan and John Smythe at the time, they were all very, very helpful, as were some of the other refs that maybe weren't in that group at the time, Laurie Annandale Dale was very helpful. Colin Brinder, you know, they were great. They helped me a lot. John Street and I had a wonderful respect for John Street. I still think he's one of one of the best referees I've ever seen. But for some reason, we didn't really hit it off, and I don't ever know what it was. And I wish sort of resolved it before he died. But he didn't do me any harm, but he wasn't particularly helpful towards me. But you know, the other refs were great, and they always have been. You know, I still keep in touch with John Williams a bit now. I spoke to Alan Chamberlain the other day; it was his birthday. Yeah. Sadly, you know, we've lost a few of the others, but no, they were all good to me in my career. I have to be fair.
But did you, in those days, did you see refereeing as a career, or was it just something you enjoyed doing?
No, I didn't. During that stint in Blackpool in 1992, I picked up a job with Alston Elliott, who were a computer graphic scoring company. And they were doing, during I think it was 3 days off was all we had in that Blackpool stint, but although we were off, they brought the top 16 players in and they resurrected Pot Black. It was called Pot Black Time Frame, and they needed somebody who knew a little bit about computers and also knew the rules to do the scoring. So through the tournament director at the time, Ann Yates, they approached me and said, look, you know, we know you've only got these 3 days off, but we really need somebody, and would you like to do it? And the pay was quite handy, so I agreed to do it, and then that ended up leading to a full-time job. I worked for them for 9 years. So as long as part of my deal with Alston Elliott was they wanted my refereeing experience and knowledge, so I said, well, as long as I can do, I think at the time you had to do 2 weeks a year minimum to maintain your membership of the Professional Referees Association. So they used to give me best part of a month to do different tournaments, and I just thought that that would be the way it would continue, you know. But things changed. Will Snooker came to me 9 years after I started and offered me a full-time job, and I thought perhaps it's time for a change, and it was something I'd always wanted, so I took a gamble.
Yeah, well, let's just go back to Alston Elliott, because they're kind of unsung heroes really of the TV coverage, aren't they? You know, people, when you see the pot success on the screen and all that stuff, and all the stats basically that you see are generated by the guys in the truck.
That's right, yeah. We started all that. There was BBC at the time were looking for a new edge. Alston Elliott had started, I think snooker was their first event, but they were promised doing all the cricket coverage on the back of it, because the Beeb were the main broadcasters of cricket back then. And cricket is just, it's 99% statistically driven.
Yeah.
And they tried to adapt some of that into snooker. And it was difficult at the time, because a lot of the old school didn't believe in the stats. It was, if you score more points, you won. You know, but we talked a few people around, and because I was collating a lot of the statistics at the time, I think that gave it a little bit of credibility. A few of the players were partly on my side, because they knew at least I had a bit of knowledge of it. And that was where it went. And they delivered a very good product. They were a great company to work for. Very professional, really liked what they did. And we were at that time of change. You know, widescreen TVs had suddenly come about. Digital TV had come in. Graphics machines to put things on screen were a lot better. It was the right place at the right time, I think.
And you got to do the cricket as well?
Yeah, I did the cricket. I was never a big cricket fan. I still watch cricket now. I prefer one day. It used to be really tedious for me at a test match. I mean, don't get me wrong, and I appreciated the work, but you turn up at a test match, they always started on Thursdays back in those days. You know, when you'd get to Saturday afternoon knowing it was a draw, thinking, why have I got to stay here for another 2.5 days? But, you know, it was one of those things. I mean, I did enjoy it. I did a few tours. I went to India. I did turn down a West Indies tour, but that was because it clashed with something else. I went out to Sri Lanka. I went to Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. And of course, all around the domestic season, because snooker and cricket back then worked hand in hand. Because when we finished snooker the first week of May, the cricket had kicked in.
Yeah.
They finished towards the end of August, and we started again in September. So the seasons worked great for as regards a full time job, anyway.
But like you say, then you came back to refereeing, and you pretty quickly established yourself as one of the top referees. And I guess some of the older referees you mentioned earlier were kind of retiring or just sort of, you know, kind of getting too old to do it, really.
Yeah, it was around that time. It was quite political as well, because it was at the time where...
Surely not.
Well, for a change. No, it was when, I think it was 110 Sport, and they announced they were looking to set up a rival tour, and I think World Snooker, maybe not a knee-jerk reaction, it was probably the right thing at the time, but they said, look, we need to get some referees on contract, that if this does happen, you know, we can still try and have the best product. So they started offering a few contracts that we didn't think would ever come around. And I think the main reason I got offered one was because in the build-up in 4 or 5 years previous to that, I'd done all the Premier League stuff.
Yeah.
So although I'd only done my 2 or 3 weeks with World Snooker, I'd been on television with Premier League, I'd kept in touch with all the players, I was at every event. Obviously, I was watching more snooker than anybody, I would think, the fact I was scoring nearly every match. So that was how it all came about, you know.
Let's talk about a sort of referee's day, because I think obviously again a lot of people who watch snooker on the telly, they kind of see you there in the middle, but they've no no reason to know what your preparation is or what you do. So, for example, say you're reffing at the Crucible 10 in the morning. You know, what time do you get up and what's your little routine before the match starts?
Generally get up around 8 o'clock. Sheffield's quite a good one for us because we stay at a hotel that's a nice 15-minute walk from the venue, so that's quite a nice start in the morning. So I get up around 8. I'm not a big one for early mornings and breakfast, but the Crucible, we all tend to have a different routine, so have a bit of breakfast, walk in. Our written rule is that you're always on site, dressed and ready to work 40 minutes before your scheduled start time. So by 9:20 we're out. You know, we've got the balls out, we're checking the table. A lot of people don't know this, but because of the table heaters now and all the experiments they've done with kicks and things in the past, obviously there's oil in the cloth and oil on the balls from when they're brand new. So we now don't put the balls on the table until 30 minutes before, because that can cause little heat spots and all these different things. So yeah, get the balls on the table for 9:30 if it's a 10 o'clock start. Go and find your players, just let them know that you're refereeing them. Very often with television, we don't start dead on 10 o'clock. So it might be a 10:03 or a 10:04, so at least you let the players know they've got those extra few minutes. Find your marker, have a chat, make sure he's got your bottle of water out, and away to go.
Right, and in the interval, will you just take it easy, or is any more duties?
You don't get much time in the intervals, that's the thing. I mean, they're 15-minute breaks, which the players go off and have 15 minutes, but we tend to stay at the table because we take the balls off the table. We wait for the table fitted to service the table. Then we set the balls back up, and that generally takes 6 or 7 minutes. So you've only got another 5 minutes then before you've got to find your players ready to come back out. But it gives you time to go to the toilet, and you know, you just basically keep yourself to yourself. If you start getting involved in conversations with people, it can destroy your concentration, which is always the biggest thing. I mean, to any referees listening to this, the only advice I ever give anybody is don't lose concentration. Because it's very easy to start concentrating, but it's very tough to get it back once you've lost it. So,
and after the match, do you have any duties? Sort of hand in the match sheet or anything like that, and that's it, is it?
No, not really. At the Crucible and most big events, you've got a marker doing it all for you, so that's down to them. So all you do is put the balls back in the box, make sure everybody's happy. Mm. If there's been any incidents, you might write a report. If you've issued a warning or anything, we always record those on paper. But then, no, you just go off and get yourself ready for your next session.
Mm. Okay, well, as you said, you refereed the Premier League, which was high profile, live TV and all the rest of it. But 2004, you got the chance to referee the World Final. Mm. I think you were the youngest person to do it. Yeah.
I won't be for much longer, I don't think, but yeah.
But I mean, that must have been a great honour.
Oh, it was fantastic, and I wasn't expecting it. I thought it might have been another 3 or 4 years, in all honesty. And back then, I was told the previous October, which is unheard of now. You normally don't know until after Christmas, until the same year, effectively. But I was told that I had to keep it quiet for a month, and that was tough. Mm. I phoned my mother and told her, because I was allowed to, I told my partner at the time, who's now my wife, Karen, she knew about it. But we kept it quiet until the end of January, I think, which is the normal sort of time now when they announce it. But I couldn't wait. You know, I was a bit concerned that maybe I hadn't done enough at the Crucible, because I think I'm the only referee to have never done a one table prior to doing a final. Yeah. Normally you get a semi-final, and the following year you get the final. Yeah. That didn't happen in my case. I'm not sure what the reason was for that, but... I loved every second of it. I can still remember certain shots from that final, certain things I felt and the way it all was. Mm. So, yeah.
But were you nervous, though, going out there? Because, I mean, the attention is on you as well, isn't it? Particularly in a match like that. If you make a mistake in a normal match, people will kind of forgive it. But if you do it in the final, the World Championship, they won't.
No, I was absolutely fine up until about a minute before the intros, because I'm stood backstage and I'm listening to everything that's going on. And it was Alan Hughes was our MC at the time. And all the build-up, I mean, as you know, there's a lot happens in the arena that you might not see on television. Yeah. It all looks seamless, but there's a lot going on. And one of my heroes in the game, one of my idols, was always Steve Davis. He was, obviously he was the main man when I started watching, and I've always got on really well with Steve. And he recorded a link at the far side of the Crucible, and he made the effort to come right round the back of the Crucible just to come and see me, and basically said, look, you've earned this, just go out and do a job. And I was fine until he did that to me. And at that point I basically crumbled. And I still get it now. I think when the day comes when I'm not a little bit nervous, if I can't get focused for a match, then that will be the time to say, okay, I've had a good career, enough's enough. But it's, hopefully that's a good few years away.
But you mentioned concentration, and that's obviously the big thing. I mean, we all know there are certain matches that can be very kind of scrappy, and if you're just watching, even if you're commentating, you can sort of switch off, but you cannot afford to do that. So how do referees keep that sort of iron concentration? Is it just through experience?
I think it is just experience, because you can't shut off from everything, because you are responsible for what happens in the crowd. You know, you have to pick out people who look like they might be a problem, and you know, try and deal with them before they're a problem. Very often you might see us between frames gone call when the security guy's down, because we've seen something that could be an issue. You know, I think prevention is a very good cure. You know, once problems start, then they tend to escalate. So you have to keep your eye on all those things, but you've got to be focused on the match as well. I think it helps me because I don't play much now, but I mean, I did get to a level where I made century breaks, and you know, I played a lot of amateur stuff. So I tend to follow the game, but you also have to follow the game differently as a referee, because you know, as a player, you're looking sort of 2-3 shots ahead. As a referee, you're only concerned with the current shot and the next one.
Sure.
You can't go too far ahead, because you can talk yourself out of things.
But positioning is so important, isn't it, in refereeing? Particularly, I watched you, I can't remember what the tournament was, it may have been the Champion of Champions, you refereed Ronnie O'Sullivan. And obviously, you know, we know how quick Ronnie is, particularly when he's break building. And I was actually just watching you, and you were like making sure you were getting in position not to put him off, not to be in his way. But you have to anticipate that, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
Understand what he's doing, and that's where knowledge of the game comes in.
Yeah, but I think any referee trying to anticipate what Ronnie O'Sullivan's going to do, you're going to get yourself in trouble, as a lot of players can't do it, you know, because Ronnie just, I think he's got this first sight, he sees things, and it's a brilliant talent to have. Basically, with Ronnie, I mean, we've had chats all the years I've known him. And, you know, he's been very critical of some referees, but he's had cause to be with some of them as well. The majority of times, I don't think he has had reason to, but, you know, he has had it with a few. But he's got this opinion that he doesn't care if you're stood right in front of him as long as you stand still. Yeah. Now, we don't like that as referees. We'd never try and stand in front of a player, always get behind the eye line. But I think with Ronnie is, as long as you know what he expects, then it's, like you say, it's very tough top of the table getting around and getting back and forth. And I think he's about the only player that I let the player go first.
Right.
Because I ref a lot of billiards, and billiard players always want the referee in to do their bit.
Yeah.
But with Ronnie, I'll always let him walk, because I know that once he's got out of my way, he's out for me to do what I need to do.
Sure.
So I don't referee any player differently, other than I think that's a bit of a concession I make with him.
Okay, so you refereed, as you say, the World Final 2004. I think I'm right in saying after that you took a bit of a break then. At some point.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I said it was down to politics, the reason I came in, and it was politics that made me leave in the end. We had a very, well, I'll say it was a shocking administration. The way the game was run was appalling. I was an employee at the time. I had 2 pay cuts enforced on me in one season. And it just got to the point that I could make a living, but I didn't enjoy what I was doing anymore. I still loved the game. I just didn't like working for the administration that we had, and I tried always to resolve it, and they just weren't listening. So in the end, I very unfortunately I resigned. I was a full-time referee. I'd got where I'd worked very hard to get, and I called it a day in 2005. Now, I don't regret for 1 minute leaving, because I felt I held my principles, and I did what was right at the time. But then I think one of the best days of my life was when I got the phone call from Nigel Oldfield, who's now operations director, to say that, you know, Barry was in. He was going to come back and do a bit of work for Barry, and Barry had told him to ring me and see if I wanted to come back, you know, and that was a fantastic time. So
And things have changed a lot, as we know, in the sport since Barry took over. And one thing that's changed for you is you don't just referee now, you're also tournament director, and that's another job title that people hear but maybe don't really understand what goes on. So what does a tournament director do?
Well, tournament director, it's a different role, really, to what it used to be. When I started in 1992, we had a lady called Anne Yates, who everybody remembers. I mean, she was an amazing tournament director. I think everybody respected her, players and referees.
A lot of people were scared of her, I think.
I think that was part of the reason, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, if you got on the wrong side of her, you knew about it, but she was very, very fair, and she gave me my chance, really. It was down to her that initial conversation with Alston Elliott happened and all that. But her job back then was, really speaking, she had a press officer and an assistant TD, and they did the bulk of the dirty work, if you like. And Anne was sort of a figurehead. I'm in charge. I will deal with everything. And she did it very, very well. Well, that's all changed now over the years. Anne left. Mike Ganley was involved. He was sort of the assistant TD under Anne, and he's very much got a lot of Anne's ways about him, you know, which is very good. But now we're a lot more hands-on. A tournament director will turn up two, maybe 3 days before an event. All the scoring equipment and the computers that you may not see, but you certainly see the benefit of if you're watching it with live scores and things. We actually install all that equipment. You know, we put it in, we cable it, we do all the administration side of things, we allocate the matches, we do the referees' rotas. There's a heck of a lot of admin, even down to maybe 6 months before an event. Even events like the Crucible, where we seem to have been going forever, we still go for a planning meter every year. We still look at every venue in case things have changed. There's a lot of notes and a lot of paperwork, you know, because these are big events and they have to run properly. So the TD's role is it's two things. It's getting all the preparation right, and it's getting the final stages right.
And some of it's pretty frenzied. I mean, if you look at the Home Nations events, where you've got eight tables, play all day long. Yeah. You know, you've got to keep on top of it. If matches are overrunning, you've got to reallocate tables. It's full on, isn't it?
It's full on, and it all started. I don't think many people could have coped with the Home Nations if we hadn't done the European Tour events, because they were sort of the model for that, where we played the same format, but we did it in 3 days.
You know,
at least now we play these in seven.
Yeah.
But of course, we have more tables. But, you know, you have a good format, you have a structure that works. I know some matches go on 2 hours later than they were scheduled for, but I think a lot of players are starting to realise now that, you know, a not before time just means that is the earliest, it's not when you're going to get on.
Yeah.
You know, and we try and get matches turned around as quick as we can, and I think players appreciate it a lot more now when they work with us. But, yeah, it can be chaos. I mean, you can suddenly have a spell of, say, an hour and a half where very little has happened, and then you get five matches come off within 2 minutes of each other, so that there's a lot to do. But as long as you stay on top of it. But those events, we work very well, whether it's, there's a team of us really, there's myself, Martin Clark and Mike Ganley are now full-time tournament directors, and we've got Gary Wilkinson, who's worked with us for a long time as an ATD. We've also got Brendan Moore now, who's coming into that role, and Jan Verhaas is doing a little bit. So between us, we'll always pair up for those events, so one of us will tend to just sit in a corner behind a computer doing the allocations, liaising with television, making sure everyone knows what's happening. And then the other one will be out face-to-face with the players, dealing with any issues, making sure the referees know where they're going. So although they're very long days, you know, they can be 16, 17-hour days, and you might get three or four of them in a row, that they work okay. So it's, yeah.
You are at the sharp end, though, aren't you? Because snooker is not without people that want to complain or have their say about things, and you've got players, tournaments, you've got the your fellow officials, you've got the broadcasters, lots of people, sponsors to keep happy. It's not always easy to keep everyone happy, is it?
No, not at all. And I mean, snooker is one of those sports where everybody knows everything, or they think they do. You've only got to pick up social media for a day, and you understand that. So, no, it's, you know, from our point of view, we stay out of social media as much as possible. I mean, I've got my accounts, you know, where I just put a little bit on to let people know what I'm doing. A lot of, like, Mike Ganley, Martin Clark, they won't go anywhere near social media, which is probably a good thing. Because if they saw half the stuff I read, it would be chaos. But yeah, there's a lot going on. You know, you do have issues. Players obviously have problems. A lot of them are justified. Some of them maybe not so. But it's your job to listen to them and try and deal with them. Some of the most mundane comments you have can actually lead to some of the biggest changes, you know, which is good for everybody. You know, we're always thinking. That's one thing Barry's got, is if you go to Barry with an idea or a suggestion, I mean, obviously think about it first, because if it is nonsense, he'll tell you. You know, but if he thinks something will work, he will put things in place to give it a try. So, yeah, it's, you know, a lot of things related to conditions. You know, players will say, "Well, that table played shocking," you know, and it's, but you might know that if it had rained heavy the night before, and maybe the heating was turned off for a few hours, and you understand these things, it doesn't make it right. You know, but if there's things you can resolve, you'll deal with them. You pacify the players, and you just try and make things happen.
One thing, though, both refereeing and tournament directing, you're away a lot, aren't you? I mean, there's a lot of time on the road. I know you say you divide it up between you, but there's still a lot of tournaments to cover, and you sort of have to spend a lot of time away from home, which is hard for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, I was, funny enough, I finished doing my my accounts last night, because I've just finished as self-employed, so I've done the last year's books, and I looked, and it was actually 207 nights in hotels in a calendar year, which is a long time ago. Because I only recently got married last year. We've been together for 17 years. We only married last year. But luckily, I think she knows that's the way it is. You know, it is a long time away. I won't say I enjoy being away from home, but I tolerate it. I'm used to it. You know, it's great now. You can have video phone calls, because I've got a couple of grandchildren and things, and I can keep in touch with them, and that's a good side of it. Also, what's good is we have a very good tour. You know, I get on well with a lot of players. I get on well with a lot of referees. I get on well with a few of the security guys. A lot of the broadcasters, you know, the TV people, a lot of the journalists. We are, I won't say we're a family, but we're all quite close.
Yeah.
So that makes things a lot easier as well.
Yeah. A family, like in The Godfather.
Well, yeah, it can be.
Well, like you say, when you you came back and you became established as again one of the top refs, and you got to do the World Final again, 2016.
Yeah.
Mark Selby and Ding Junhui. What was that like, sort of 12 years on? You probably felt less nervous, did you? Or how, can you remember how you felt?
I think I felt a bit less nervous. Yeah. I was as aware of it, but I was probably a little bit more confident because I felt that over those years I'd become a better referee than I was in 2004. Certainly from an experience point of view, you know, I'd learned a lot more things. That I'd seen a lot more situations. There's a lot more things that I'd already dealt with. Because a lot of amateur referees particularly watch professional referees on television and they say, oh, if that had happened to me, I would have done that. Well, you don't know what you would have done until you're out there. You know, when we all have the rules knowledge to back up our decisions, whichever decision we make, but you actually don't know. I mean, I had the incident with Ronnie and Ali Carter at the Crucible this year.
Yeah.
You know, where actually Barry said, well, I handled it. I didn't actually know what I was doing. You know, you see a situation, you see two players who are obviously fired up. And I didn't really know how to deal with it, and it was just, look, you know, come on, lads, let's just play snooker. That was, to me, that was the obvious thing to do, and it worked. You know, but you don't know what you do in these situations. Sure. But when I did that final, you know, when I went out to do that, I was a lot more confident. I was nervous, but I enjoyed it.
Good. Two mundane questions. Firstly, what's in your pocket as a referee? You know, we see you in the big blazer. What have you actually got in that pocket?
Two ball markers and a coin.
Okay.
That's it. Yep. A pen in the inside pocket, just in case.
Is it a lucky coin? I know some refs have lucky coins.
No, I'm actually gutted. I did have a lucky coin and I've lost it. I was given.
Wasn't that lucky then?
No, well, it should have been. Colin Brindid, who, you know, we lost 12 years ago now, Colin, he was very good to me and he gave me a coin. It was a Kennedy silver American half dollar, and it was in that spell where I had a break, and although I was still using it for Premier League, so I'm hoping one day it turns up, and I'm sure it's in the house somewhere. But there's a great story with a lucky coin if you've got a minute.
Yeah.
I was in Blackpool in my first ever year in 92, and Len Ganley was stood next to me, and we used to queue up in a tunnel, so there'd be 22 tables, so there'd be 44 players and 22 referees all lined up in this area. It was more like a crowd queue to go in a football match, but we were all there. So I tossed the coin with the two players, and Len said, "What's that?" I said, "What do you mean, what's that?" He said, "Well, what coin have you got there?" So it's 10 pence piece. No, Paul. He said, "We don't use mundane coins." He said, "We, as professional referees, we all have a coin. I tell you what," he said, I'll give you a coin. I'll bring one in tonight for you." And he was living in Blackpool at the time. So we came back that evening, and good to his word, Lenny went there, and he said, "You have that, and when you do your first world final with that coin," he said, "you remember your uncle Len gave it to you," and I'll never forget that. And I went, "Oh, Len, that's fantastic, thank you." And it was a Churchill half crown. It was a huge coin. It was a bit like if you see a £5 coin now, it's about that size. And it was in a little gift box. And I used it for, must have been 5 days before I realised that it had the Queen's head on one side and Churchill's head on the other. So it was only Len could ever have given a referee a double-headed coin to toss with for the rest of his career.
We could do a whole podcast on Len, couldn't we? He was unbelievable character. Yeah.
But I have still got that coin, but obviously I don't use it. So.
The other question, and this seems really kind of mundane, but we see quite often in snooker, after a couple of frames, a player will go to the toilet. Referees never have that chance. Now, obviously, you're not drinking water every other shot, but there must be times when you think, I need to go.
You can. If you need to go, you can go.
Right.
You know, some of the female referees, I think, you know, obviously, we've got a different makeup, and they tend to go a little bit more than we do. But if you need to go, you need to go. It's as simple as that. It's like we always said with the players. We think some players were going a little bit too often. They weren't going to the toilet. They were going out and composing themselves, and that isn't what it's all about. But, you know, you can't stop somebody going to the toilet if they need to go. We encourage people not to do it unless you have to. But I think over the years I've just become sort of immune to it now. I can sort of just shut myself off, you know, and I'm all right normally.
Yeah.
I've been in my whole career, so 27th season now on the main tour, and once I've had to go during a match, that's all. So.
Okay, not a bad record.
No.
Anyone listening to this who maybe fancies giving refereeing a go, what kind of...
Don't do it.
I was going to say, what advice would you give them? I mean, obviously you start, don't you, well, the traditional path is you start your local league, so I think there's three certificates you pass.
That's right.
Yeah,
you start with a class three, or it was a grade C as it was when I took it, but class three, class two and a class one. Anybody can take a class three. Just get in touch with your local association, snooker association. They'll put you in touch with whoever the coordinating referee is. Take your exam. It's quite a basic exam. It's only a limited rules knowledge. And then they will encourage you to do more refereeing with more experienced referees and obviously pick up more of the trade. After you've been 2 years as a class three, if your examiner thinks that you're good enough, he will ask you, do you want to do a class two? you can then do that one, and then I think it's still 5 years before you can do a class one. We've always joked that you can actually become a doctor quicker than you can become a class one snooker referee, which is a bit unusual, but it's all down to the experience of the job, really.
And learn the rules. I mean, it seems an obvious thing to say, but there are certain things that never happen, but then they happen, and you need to know.
Absolutely. There's so many things that I am never, ever going to see on a snooker table, but I have to know what to do when those things arrive, when they arise. So that's the big thing, and it's remembering all those different things. So even now, I mean, I still read, I get on an aeroplane, I'll still read the rule book. You know, I mean, because you can get through it in an hour, you know, paying attention. Still do it, just because it jogs little memories all the time. But the only advice I give to anybody is, if you want to do it, but do it for the right reasons. We don't make fortunes. There are maybe five of us on the whole tour who can actually make a living at it. You know, so don't expect it to lead to a career. If you enjoy it, do it, and do as many matches as you can. That's the advice I give. I think if I hadn't done Blackpool in the day, you know, I did 2 years of that, I wouldn't be the referee I am now, because the referees coming in, you know, some of the B-band referees that we have that we're trying to promote to the A-band to get the big level of work, there's just not enough work for them. You know, we'd like them to do more, but we've got to share it out, and that's the tough part. But whereas when you went to Blackpool and you could do 2 months of two matches a day, 7 days a week, best of nines, you were wearing dress suits in the evenings, and we even brushed and ironed our own tables back then, you know, so that really was the way to learn.
And in terms of your career, I mean, you've refereed everything that you can do. What are your sort of future ambitions? Just to carry on doing it, I guess.
As long as I enjoy it the way I do now, I'm going to carry on. I actually think I enjoy it more now than I did when I came back. We were saying that when I just had the contract negotiation to come as a full-time TD. So whatever you do, don't take the reffing off me, because I really am enjoying it. I think Jan is at the point now, you know, just chatting to Jan socially. I think sort of if he didn't referee a lot more, it wouldn't bother him. He's enjoying it, you know, he loves the role. But he really enjoys being involved in the, certainly we're rewriting a few of the, not rewriting the rule, but we're not changing many rules, but we're making it easier to understand and easier to translate into other languages. So that's been a project ongoing for almost 2 years, and Jan has loved that. He's put so much work into it. You know, and he likes the training side of it, and he's a little bit older than me, and he's had a bad back for a long time, so he finds standing for a long time a bit difficult. I've gone the other way. I like having all the other roles, but I'm really enjoying reffing at the moment. So you know, I've got a good spell coming up now, because obviously we're talking about the Championship League, and I managed to do all four of these this year, so I've got 16 days of that. I'm reffing at the Masters this year. I'm actually reffing at the Welsh Open for the first time for several years, so that I'm looking forward to that. We haven't allocated anybody for the World Championships yet, but you know, I'd think I'd get a few days there at least. So yeah, I'm still really, really enjoying it. I love being involved, and you know, I'm very lucky that I get paid to do something that I get so much pleasure out of.
That's good to hear. And as Rob Walker says about the referees, we can't do it without them. They're a very integral part of the snooker circuit. It's been great to chat to you, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Dave.
Cheers.